All right. So sensation and cognition. Another argument we'll come back to, I'll just briefly summarize it here, is, and this is a very, very powerful cogent argument, and that is design as information. Now, J.P. Moreland published this book in 1987. This was just at the beginning of the formulation of this argument. He's relying on a book called The Mystery of Life's Origin, which was the first intelligent design book published by a secular publisher, the Philosophical Press. The argument is, and this is trading on some insights from Michael Polanyi, that DNA is not like a language, it is a language. And that physical laws do not exhaust the meaning of DNA. That the symbols have significance that exhausts their physical nature. It's a code. That's why it's called the genetic code. So it's a language. Now, if it's a language and it is not created by a human being, but it is a kind of language, how can we explain its existence in the universe? It's not reducible to biology and chemistry because it's a code. It has meaning. It gives instructions. It's a blueprint. It's like a living blueprint. So it has, if you will, letters, words, sentences, paragraphs, books. Now, when you find a message that is both, we'll come back to this more, specified and complex, not just merely complex, but specified. See, something can be, you take a Scrabble box and you throw out all the letters. It's very complex. But how much specificity will you find? How many letters will you find by just taking all those Scrabble pieces and randomly throwing them in the room? Probably very few. Maybe you'll find at, in, of, you know. You'll find a few very short words that can be accounted for by chance. What if you throw that out there and it says, to be or not to be, that is a question. Somebody's been monkeying around with this. All right? So, yes. Well, sure, you would still be interpreting. You'd be using your mind. You'd be identifying symbols. But the issue is whether you can account for it merely given natural law, how that falls out, and chance, how you threw it. So the idea is that if it's specified, it has a particular meaning, and if it's highly complex, the best explanation is an intelligent cause. And this is really the genius of the intelligent design movement, which deals with the large questions, the cosmic constants that we'll get to in a moment, but also deals with the very small, such as DNA, such as the bacterial flagellum, and so on. The claim is that when you look at these items in the universe at the small level and also the large level, that they are specified and they are complex, and you cannot account for them merely on natural law, because natural law produces regularities, but it doesn't produce a lot of highly specified things like sentences or paragraphs. And chance doesn't have that capacity. Natural laws produce regularities, you see, but information is not a regularity. Information has meaning, and it uses symbols to indicate states of affairs. So there's grammar, syntax, and so on. That just indicates intelligence. So the treatment you have in JP is in the early stages of this argument, and when we come back later to creation, Darwinism, and intelligent design, believe it or not, I'm going to show you a video. And the video is the best way of understanding this concept of specified complexity. It is a marvelous, ingenious video. There's no fluff. It is so amazing in the intricacy that to see it through computer graphics really brings the point home. Now, if any of you have studied like something like the bacterial flagellum and so on, you know what I'm talking about if you know a little bit about DNA. So the question here is, how do you account for DNA? It seems if it's a message, when we see messages in other contexts, don't we assume an author of the message? It's specified. It's complex. It's information. Now, Philip Johnson believes, sort of the leader of the intelligent design movement, Philip Johnson believes that what's called the information problem will be the thing that sinks Darwinism within the next several decades. Because it is extremely difficult within that naturalistic worldview to go from non-life to life. That is a tremendous ontological leap or discontinuity, or if you want to put it this way, rupture. Because the properties of information are so radically different than other types of states of affairs. The nature of a message is so different than non-message states of affairs that generating information from non-information without an intelligence is a daunting task. And this is a very powerful argument. The leading thinker now in this area is a man named Stephen Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. Maybe it's M-Y-E-R. Not sure about that. I think it's M-Y-E-R. He's with the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and he's recently published an article in the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington called The Origin of Biological Information in the Higher Taxonomic Categories. Now, what's significant about that is that the naturalists say, well, you intelligent design people, you people that don't buy Darwinism, only publish for yourselves. You write books, you have conferences, but you don't publish in referee journals. This is a referee journal. And that is extremely significant in the world of scholarship. Now, you might be thinking, what's a referee journal? Now, a referee journal is a journal that is refereed by, judged by your peers. So when I submit an article to a philosophical journal, the editor sends it out to one or two philosophers to evaluate whether it's good enough to publish. The same thing happens in science. And he's arguing that an intelligent cause is a better explanation for biological information than mere natural law and chance and a whole lot of time. And he finally got something published in a referee journal. This is very, very significant. We'll come back to these sorts of arguments, but they are cogent, powerful, and arresting arguments. Questions or comments about that? Remembering we'll dilate on more of it later. The information, yes?
How do they deal with things like memory in this physicalist type of...
Well, we'll come back to that when we talk about the argument from mind proper. It's difficult because so many of the parts of the human being are replaced, including not all, but a lot of the brain cells and so on. Keeping the continuity and accounting for memory is extremely difficult. I mean, it's more like sort of falling dominoes than it is a unified self, because you're just a succession of material states, one after the other, and you slough off a lot of your material parts and it's replaced by other parts. But you have a pretty major sea change every several years. Yeah, we claim, at least some of us claim, we're the same person. How do you account for that? If you're a substance dualist, there's a ready category, your soul. If you're not, it becomes at least very problematic. Yes?
Are you going to talk about dreams at all?
I could. Let me tell you about my dreams. I have a recurring dream.
Well, you just brought up memory and I was thinking that.
Yeah.
Dreams go beyond the physical.
Well, it's a mental state, and they would have to claim the mental state is reducible to physical third-person components. Very difficult to make that translation. Yeah. All right, let me just take about 10 or 15 minutes to talk about the final category, and then we come back. We'll talk about how to formulate the argument, some criticisms, and get in the argument from mind. Something that's only been known for about the last 20 to 35 years is this whole area of what are called anthropic coincidences, or sometimes called cosmic constants. This is often called the fine-tuning of the universe. Now, again, J.P. wrote the book, had it published, that is, in 1987. And he listed six or seven of these features of the universe that are just so, that all have to be just so to make life as we know it possible. Now, the number has increased tremendously since then. More and more principles in nature are being discovered that are finely, finely tuned. Michael Denton has a book called Nature's Dominion, I believe, where he goes into dozens and dozens of these. Hugh Ross's website has a running list of all these principles. I think it's up to 120-something by now, or more. Now, the idea is that all these different factors, which had to be built into the initial conditions of the universe, have very infinitesimal margins of error. Now, Stephen Meyer has a good way of explaining this. Now, we're talking about the universe at large now. The things that make life possible. So we're talking about necessary conditions for life. They may not be sufficient. In fact, I don't think they're sufficient. But they are necessary for life. They must be there for life to be there. Okay? He views it as many, many, dozens and dozens, probably over 100 dial settings. And you remember, some of you aren't old, some of you may be old enough. You remember radios, when radios had dials, before digital took over everything? You would have to tune in the station, remember that? Or TV sets that had those clink, clink, clink things on them before the remote. There was life before the remote. All right, think of many, many, many possible settings and then getting one of these settings. Just for the sake of argument, let's say there's a 1 in 100 chance for this. And you need that to tune in to life. But it's not just one. It's not just two. It's not just three. It's not just 10 or 20 or 30 or 40. It's dozens and dozens, probably over 100. And they all have to be perfectly tuned. Otherwise, life cannot exist in the universe. Let me quote something from Stephen Hawking. If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size. And that's pretty bad for the possibility of life. On the other hand, if the expansion rate at 1 second had been larger by the same amount, the universe would have expanded so much it would be effectively empty now. Let me quote something from Roger Penrose. How big was the original phase volume that the Creator had to aim for in order to provide the universe, provide a universe compatible with the second law of thermodynamics and with what we now observe? The Creator's aim must have been precise to an accuracy of one part in 10 to the 10th to the 123rd. This is an extraordinary figure. One could not possibly write down the number in full in the ordinary denary notation. It would be 1 followed by 10 to the 123rd successive zeros. Even if we were to write a zero on each separate proton and on each separate neutron in the entire universe, and we could throw in all the other particles as well for good measure, we should fall far short of writing down the figure needed. This is the precision needed to set the universe on its course. Now, let me give you an example from an article in a special issue of the Scientific American. This periodical is written basically for intelligent lay people. It's not an academic journal per se, but it's a fairly thoughtful journal. It's totally dominated by naturalism. The author lists only 5 remarkable features of our universe. And in fact, he failed to emphasize the precise tuning needed for each one. But he says, our universe, and this is an article by Martin Rees, R-E-E-S, Exploring Our Universe and Others. We'll get to the others in a moment. Scientific American Special Issue, 2002, page 87. Our universe could not have become structured if it were not expanding at a special rate. 1. If the Big Bang had produced few density fluctuations, the universe would have remained dark with no galaxies or stars. Again, bad news for life. If our universe had more than 3 spatial dimensions, planets could not stay in orbits around stars. If gravity were much stronger, it would crush organisms of human size, and stars would be small and short-lived. 5. If nuclear forces were a few percent weaker, only hydrogen would be stable, there would be no periodic table, and no chemistry. doesn't mean no chemistry in school, no chemistry. So, this is quite remarkable. He's only listed five. And there are many more. He doesn't even emphasize the fact that it has to be so carefully calibrated. Now, when you start doing the numbers here, the chances of all these things happening without plan, without a mind designing it, is infinitesimal to the vanishing point. Now, it's fascinating to me and heartening to me that this has only become known and systematized in the last about 30 to 40 years. Now, of course, these things have always been there. But as we learn more about the universe, we discover these principles, or these anthropic coincidences, they're called, that are necessary, that are required for life as we know it to exist. So life as we know it is extremely improbable antecedently. It's extremely unlikely that any life would ever show up. Now, how do the skeptics or the unbelievers deal with this? You tell me. Well, one of them is called the many worlds theory. I want to come back to that in a moment. This is not the only universe. There are maybe an infinity of other ones, so this one's not so amazing if you have an infinity to choose from. But there's another version of this. Yes? I don't know. Well, then you want to say, what's the most probable explanation? But see, sometimes when you press unbelievers to the wall, they come up with the I don't know, when there is another explanation. Now, you can always hold out for some naturalistic explanation. Well, there has to be some naturalistic explanation out there somewhere, somehow. And a few of them have been given. But just to say I don't know when there's a perfectly good alternative, namely a mind bringing it all together for a purpose, and there are other lines of evidence to support that hypothesis, a lot of other lines, you sometimes have to wonder. But there's another response that is almost disarming to all this. I'll give you what the writer in the Scientific American said if you don't come up with it yourself. They can't deny the coincidences. There are too many of them. And we seem to be finding more all the time. Yes? Try it.
The reason why we have life here is because, you know, because all these things exist, life reacted to all these things. Therefore, Darwinism still has its possibility because we just...
Well, you say, well, it's just lucky. It's just a lucky our number did come up. However improbable, well, here we are. You could say that. Well, the alien theory. Now, there are two versions of the alien theory. That is that the universe... Actually, no, that doesn't work because, you see, the alien theory requires all these cosmic constants. They're still necessary even if the Earth was seeded by aliens. All the background information still has to be there. So that just begs the question, the alien theory. However life arose on Earth, you've got this vast panoply of other factors that are necessary conditions. Now, I don't think they're sufficient, because I think God acted to create life. We'll get to that. But they're necessary. So actually, the alien doesn't do it. Let me read you what Martin Rees says in this Scientific American article now. Some would argue that this fine-tuning of the universe, which seems so providential, is nothing to be surprised about, since we could not exist otherwise. Let me just read a little bit on, a little bit more. Similarly, this is my own writing now, not Rees. Similarly, the late paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould attacked the anthropic cosmological argument by claiming that while it is antecedently unlikely that a particular event in history will occur, some events will happen. That some event will occur is not unlikely. Therefore, we need no special explanation for the universe. Natural laws and matter would suffice. This is sometimes called a selection effect. Well, if the universe had not selected for life, we wouldn't be here to observe the universe. Jeremy, what do you think of this argument?
I think even bringing up selection infers intelligence.
Well, they want to eliminate intelligence. Well, it's a natural selection. The universe occurred and all these natural forces produced human beings. Sure, it was implausible, but if it had not occurred, we wouldn't be here to notice all these anthropic coincidences. So that's it. So much for the appearance of providence. So much for a powerful new cosmological argument based on scientific observations. It's all over, according to Martin Rees. If it hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here to notice it. You dumb Christians. Yes. It's an observation. Well, it denies the principle of sufficient reason. It denies that there needs to be an explanation. What it does is to confuse necessary conditions with an explanation. Sure, if the necessary, and in fact, concerning a human life on Earth as well, but if the necessary and sufficient explanations for X do not occur, then X does not occur. That is a tautology. The question is, why did X occur at all? And that question is begged by this response. I'm stealing from a couple different philosophers in this example, but let me read this to you. I'm not actually stealing because I'll put the footnotes in the final book. It is undoubtedly true that unless the necessary and sufficient conditions for life appeared, we could not chart the necessary and sufficient conditions for life. That is a mere tautology. But this is not the anthropic argument for design. The case for design argues, rather, that what is antecedently unlikely is necessary for the very possibility of conscious beings knowing it. I was quoting someone there. It is this vast and overwhelming improbability, the tremendous odds against life, that generates an argument to the best explanation. It is not a tautology. Consider a parallel case. You stand quaking before a firing squad of 50 carefully trained and veteran marksmen who have been ordered by their country's dictator to execute you for crimes against their country. You hear the grizzled leader give the grim order, ready, aim, fire, followed by the explosions of 50 guns. However, this is not the last thing you experience on Earth. You see the 50 executioners staring at you, bemused, in a thinning cloud of smoke. You feel no pain, but anxiously look over your body. There are no wounds, and there are no words, except those coming from the firing squad's commander, who looks into your questioning eyes and exclaims, "Why be so surprised? If they had all hit you, you wouldn't be here to wonder why." Now, I'm stealing from a couple different examples there, but it makes perfectly good sense when something antecedently, highly improbable occurs to say, how do we account for it? Not if X occurs, the necessary and sufficient conditions for X occur. That is a tautology. And it's not an explanation. An explanation says, why did those occur? What is the best explanation for their occurrence? Or do you merely want to say, well, it's a brute fact? All right, so we talked about the argument, well, what's the big deal? If all these factors had not come together, we wouldn't be here to know it. I explain in this section the proper use of the data, how you're supposed to argue. You're not saying it is amazing that elements, whatever they are, leading to human knowers, came together here and we know it. We couldn't know it unless it came together here. Or it is amazing that these elements came about and not some other series. For X to occur, P through X must occur. And that isn't it amazing that X obtains when the necessary sufficient conditions for X obtain. That's a tautology. Rather, it is amazing that these sequence of events and all these factors came about at all, given the vast odds against them occurring by merely natural means. So you need to put the argument properly. Okay? Now, another argument that's used in the face of this vast panoply of anthropological features, all these dials finely tuned to a very small range. Another alternative to a mind having designed all this and having finally calibrated it to make it life-friendly and human-friendly is to say, well, sure, given only one universe, it's tremendously implausible. The odds are vanishingly small given one universe. But what if there are very many, maybe an infinite number of other universes where no life occurs, where the tuning is off? Now, this is not possible world semantics and metaphysics. This is a bona fide cosmological theory. It's not saying there could be other worlds in which life did not obtain. That's another issue. They're claiming that if you just have one universe, and that's what the term typically means, that the odds are just impossible, really, without a designer. So the idea is to multiply the possibilities such that the lucky number comes up. So if you roll the dice once, you know, you roll 10 die once, the chances of them all coming up one are very, very small. But if you roll hundreds and thousands and millions of times, eventually 10 ones would come up. That's the sense of this theory. It's called the many worlds theory or the many universes theory. Now, the only reason I can see for positing this theory is to avoid theism. There's absolutely no empirical support for it. In fact, there cannot be any empirical support because these other universes are thought to be completely discontinuous from our own. They are unknowable in principle. Now, just given the virtues of a scientific theory that's worth believing, this argument is utterly worthless. For one thing, how about explanatory simplicity? One universe designed by a mind, or a million universes, or an infinite number of universes where one of them happens to come up like ours, but of course we have no access to these universes whatsoever. They're merely conjectural. Seems on explanatory simplicity, theism wins. In terms of dealing with the evidence you're supposed to explain and not multiplying entities unnecessarily, theism makes a lot more sense. Moreover, if the arguments of a Kalam are correct, you can't have an actual infinite number of things anyway. So you couldn't have an actual infinite number of other universes. So that wouldn't work if the Kalam argument works, that there cannot be an instantiated actual infinite. So it seems to me, and I've got a quote from Richard Swinburne on the webpage about this, that the only reason this theory was created was as an ad hoc way of avoiding theism. Now, some people say, yes, well, of course, because to remain truly scientific, you cannot be theistic in your explanation. That is, you may believe in God, but theism can never enter into a scientific theory and have it be a scientific theory. That's called a form of scientism. Now, we'll argue against that later. But for one thing, maybe at some point the scientific evidence points beyond science itself. Isn't that possible? And this many universe theory is so wildly implausible. I mean, talk about heavy duty metaphysics here. Theism is awfully simple and straightforward compared to many universe theory. That's metaphysics with a vengeance. And we're supposed to be tough-minded, hardcore, empirical, physical. Let's explain what it is. Nothing but the facts, ma'am, you know. But we've got a million, billion, infinite number of other universes that we have no epistemic access to. Come on, that's heavy-duty metaphysics with a vengeance. Theism's a piece of cake compared to that. So this theory is an exemplar of the ad hoc theory. Your theory fails, and so you make an ad hoc adjustment, not very minor in this case, but major, an infinite number of other universes to which we have no epistemic access whatsoever. We can only conjecture that they exist. Why? So we don't have to be theists. This is a very bad explanation. Yes. No, you can have a lot of existent universes that without life. It's not that all these things have to be there to have a universe at all. Now, in some cases, maybe the universe would have already reached heat death or something, or might have collapsed in on itself or something. I mean, there are a lot of possible scenarios given, you know, counterfactual physics or something. But there are a lot of universes that might exist without life. But they're saying they actually exist, but we have no contact with them. They're merely, we know it by conjecture, in order to get out of the intelligent design explanation for this vast assemblage of cosmic coincidences, which are ultimately, from our vantage point, not coincidences. Now, what's really interesting here, to kind of take a step back a little bit, and we'll come back to eight criticisms of the design argument, and then get into the argument for mind and for mind, that it's interesting to me to see how naturalists respond to these new arguments. The argument that receives intellectual fuel from the Big Bang, the Kalam argument. Now, going back to Bertrand Russell in the essay you read, Why I'm Not a Christian, he just said, well, the universe has just always been there. What's wrong with that? You could say that in the 1940s and get away with it. You can't say it now. So now what do you have to say if you're not a Christian, not a theist? It popped into existence without a cause. That's an even more implausible notion than the universe having always been there. And it's completely counterintuitive and counterfactual with respect to anything we know. So it's a kind of a leap of faith. Now, there have been design arguments for thousands of years. Psalm 19 appeals to a sense of design to ground the existence of God. God's handiwork is evident in the universe. Romans 1 also. But now, in 2004, we have dozens and dozens and dozens of these anthropic coincidences that were not even known several decades ago. And we always knew that life was somewhat finely balanced, carefully balanced, and kind of on the edge because we're contingent. So many things have to come together for life. But now we know it at such a vast expanse that it's really quite amazing. So the just there response, the brute fact response, well, it's just the way it is, you know, or if it hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here to know it. I mean, that's really a crummy argument. It's not an argument at all. And the many universe theory is just a desperation move. I don't like football, but it's kind of like a Hail Mary pass. The end of the game. It's even worse than that. It's like a Hail Mary pass thrown in the wrong direction. Okay? Now, this should hearten you. This should encourage you. I've been a Christian for about 30 years. And a lot of these arguments, the Kalam argument, the Big Bang, the anthropic, was just getting started when I became a Christian in June of 1976. It was just bubbling, boiling, starting to formulate and coagulate. Now, there are very refined, sophisticated, powerful versions of these arguments that are being presented in academic journals, in books, in public lectures, and I hope even made known in parachurch ministries, in discipleship groups, and preached and taught in the church. This is really a stupid time to be a theist. It's always a stupid time. But this is an especially stupefied time to be a theist, because the arguments are getting better and better. There's more evidence available. The practitioners of these arguments are more analytically sophisticated and in places of influence and are not afraid to advance the arguments. All right, questions or comments so far? I want to give you some criticisms of the design argument in general. Yes, and tell me your name. Carrie. Good. Well, the problem with using the cosmic constants on a young Earth view is that you're appealing to receive knowledge from physics and astronomy, which all assumes a 13 to 15 year old billion year old universe, and then saying, well, they all believe this, but we believe the universe is 10,000 years old. Now, I mean, these things exist in the universe, however they got there. All these factors are there, and they are necessary, and they're extremely fine-tuned for life, and that just cries out for a designer, if you look at it sanely, I think. But then to say that the vast, huge majority of physicists and astronomers and astrophysicists and so on are wrong, not just off by a little bit, you know, but it's really about 10,000 as opposed to 15 billion, that's kind of an odd use of the data, to my mind. Now, I know that a lot of Christians think that to be faithful to the Bible, you have to affirm that. Well, I don't think the Bible requires it, honestly. I think it leaves it open. And because it leaves it open, we should interpret the book of nature the best we can. And as I said before, and we'll talk about it more later, I'll give the naturalist 15 billion years and you still won't come up with life and human beings, or even the basic cosmic constants of the universe without God. I'll give you 15 billion years. You're still in deep yogurt. So don't worry that, well, you know, the old young Earth position was always the evolutionists need lots and lots and lots of time for evolution to work and for everything to get going. It doesn't matter. You can give them all the billions of years they want. It still doesn't work. Jeremy? Sure.
So you just have a giant contingent set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. I mean, you could even grant, for the sake of argument, there are all these other universes. Why do they exist? Where do they come from? Do they support themselves ontologically? So you could give a kind of vertical cosmological argument. If anything exists, there must be a reason for its existence. Maybe Leibnizian, maybe Thomistic. And still say you haven't explained it without God.
Well,
right? Well, why they exist at all is the issue. But still, you know, the many worlds theory is just so wildly extravagant and far-fetched, I think we should just cut it off at the knees. Say this is just ad hoc. Did I miss anything? Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like they want to admit a ghost in the machine.
Well, you may get a sense of wonder and amazement, but even Stephen Jay Gould had that. He wrote a book called Wonderful Life, and he was an atheist and a materialist, but he gives no credit to anything beyond the universe. Now, I don't watch television, but I imagine that all those Discovery Channel programs have a very strong naturalistic bent. Although I believe that some public broadcasting channel, maybe not the Discovery Channel, showed this video that I'll show later in the class, Lord willing, called Unlocking the Mystery of Life, which is an intelligent design approach. But the vast majority are all from a naturalistic perspective and don't even give any credit at all to any other perspective. So they might be kind of amazed at the wonders and the complexity, but they're given a preset interpretation for all the data. Now, we need to come up and say there's a different interpretation. There's a different way of looking at it. And don't believe everything you see on television, please. In fact, the basic principle is don't believe anything you see on television. All right, now forms of the argument. There's a very dense section about different ways to construct the argument. I'm going to try to simplify it and just say this. I think what JP says is very good, and if you're really into the epistemology of explanations there, it's worth thinking about. But the way to kind of sum it all up, I think, is just to talk about an inference to the best explanation. What hypothesis seems to explain the vast complexity and order and simplicity and beauty and so on of the universe? A mindless one or a minded one? Given an impersonal materialistic universe that popped into existence for no cause, with no cause, for no reason, and then generated all these natural laws that are also finely tuned for life. I mean, what explains that? Is that an explanation, a good explanation for what we have? Or is a better explanation a mind-first example, a mind-first explanation where these things are brought into being by a supernatural, immaterial being who has knowledge, who has a will, who is an agent, who has a mind, who can arrange all the features and facets of the universe to make them conducive to life and make the universe intelligible and beautiful. So I think you can appeal to a best explanation sort of an argument.